In the sweltering heat of Florida's backroads, bodies started turning up, one after the other, shot, stripped, dumped like trash. The victims? Middle-aged men. The suspect? A female hitchhiker, armed and unapologetic. Her name was Aileen Wuornos, and she would become the first woman in American history to be labeled a serial killer for killing men she claimed had raped or tried to rape her. To some, she was a remorseless predator hiding behind a victim's mask. To others, she was a broken soul, a prostitute brutalized by life who finally fought back. Her trial turned into a media circus. Her execution ignited fierce moral and legal debate. But the question that still burns decades later is this. Was Aileen Wuornos the monster America wanted her to be? Or the mirror it refused to look into? Because behind the mugshots and soundbites is a story of incest, foster abuse, sex work, mental illness, police corruption, and a justice system desperate for a scapegoat. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Hell on Wheels, The Making of a Serial Killer, Born to Break. Aileen Carol Pittman was born on February 29, 1956, a leap year baby, a child of misfortune. Her biological father, Leo Dale Pittman, was a diagnosed schizophrenic and convicted child molester who hung himself in prison when Aileen was just 13. Her mother, Diane, abandoned her at 4 years old, leaving Aileen and her brother Keith in the care of their grandparents in Troy, Michigan. From the beginning, there was no love, only survival. Her grandfather, Lori, was a violent alcoholic. Her grandmother was rumored to be an enabler who numbed her conscience with booze. Aileen later alleged sexual abuse at the hands of her grandfather and beatings with belts and broom handles. By age 11, she was exchanging sexual acts for cigarettes and food at school. At 14, she was pregnant, the result of a rape by an older man. The baby was given up for adoption, and Aileen was thrown out of the house shortly after. She lived in the woods, slept in abandoned cars, ate from dumpsters. She was still a teenager. Turning tricks on the highway. In her late teens and early 20s, Wuornos roamed the country, eventually drifting into Florida. She made a living the only way she knew how, as a prostitute on the highways. Her Johns were truckers, traveling businessmen, tourists. She would hitch rides, have sex for money, and vanish into the next county. She also had a string of arrests, disorderly conduct, DUI, theft, forging checks. She once beat a man with a beer bottle at a bar. But her criminal record wasn't remarkable until 1989. She was living in Daytona Beach with a woman named Tyria Moore, a hotel maid. The two formed a romantic relationship that became Aileen's emotional anchor. It was also her Achilles heel. What Wuornos did next, and why, would spark one of the most disturbing and divisive debates in the history of American crime. Victim number one, Richard Mallory. On November 30, 1989, 51-year-old electronics store owner Richard Mallory picked up a hitchhiker on Route 1 in Florida. That hitchhiker was Aileen Wuornos. 2 days later, Mallory's car was found abandoned. His body wouldn't be discovered for 2 more weeks. He had been shot 3 times in the chest, his corpse dumped in a wooded area. Police chalked it up to a robbery gone wrong. What they didn't know, not yet, was that this was just the beginning. Wuornos would later claim that Mallory brutally raped her after tying her up. She said she shot him in self-defense, but evidence showed she took his car and pawned his belongings under a false name. The press wouldn't find out until much later that Mallory had a criminal history of sexual violence, including a stint in a psychiatric facility for deviant behavior toward women. That fact was never allowed in court, and so the narrative was set. Wuornos was a prostitute who preyed on innocent men. The killing spree continues. Between May and November 1990, the bodies piled up. David Spears, 47, a construction worker, shot 6 times. Charles Carskadden, 40, a part-time rodeo worker, shot 9 times. Troy Burris, 50, a sausage delivery man, shot 2x. Charles Dick Humphreys, 56, a retired police chief, shot 6 times. Walter Gino Antonio, 62, a truck driver and security guard, shot 4 times, found nude. Peter Seams, 65, a missionary. His body was never found, but his car was. Traced back to Aileen and Tyria. The weapon, a 22 caliber pistol. The pattern, men found dead, usually nude, wallets gone, cars missing. The suspect, a hitchhiking woman who left behind pawn slips, fingerprints, and eventually, her lover. Tyria Moore, fearing she'd be implicated, flipped on Aileen. The betrayal. By January 1991, Warnos was arrested on an outstanding warrant at the Last Resort biker bar in Volusia County. Tyria, under police guidance, called Aileen from another location and coaxed her into confessing. Over 3 days, Aileen tried to protect Tyria, even claiming full responsibility. Eventually, she cracked. Her taped confessions were riddled with contradictions. In one moment, she claimed self-defense. In the next, she mocked her victims, calling them scumbags and rapists. She swore they tried to beat, sodomize, or kill her. But the evidence didn't always support those claims. Still, something about her voice, manic, broken, bitter, made the world listen. She wasn't your average serial killer. She didn't stalk from shadows. She didn't hide bodies in basements. She shot men in the face and took their cars. She wasn't ashamed. She was angry. The trial of the century. Aileen was tried first for the murder of Richard Mallory. Her public defenders were overwhelmed, and her mental health was never fully addressed in court. The prosecution painted her as a cold-blooded predator who lured men to their deaths under the guise of sex. Her own words, taken from confessions and media interviews, helped seal her fate. She rambled about space aliens, government conspiracies, and how she wanted the electric chair. She got what she asked for. In January 1992, she was found guilty of Mallory's murder and sentenced to death. 5 more death sentences would follow. She became a media sensation, America's damsel of death, a woman who had turned the predator-prey dynamic upside down and dared to say she had the right to kill. The media's monster TV crews swarmed. Filmmakers paid thousands for access. She gave interviews to everyone. British documentarians, American talk shows, tabloid reporters. Her erratic behavior grew more disturbing over time. She claimed police knew about the murders in advance and let them happen to profit from her capture. She accused her lawyers of exploiting her. She blamed the court system, God, the state of Florida. And yet, beneath the rage, there was a pattern. Childhood trauma. Mental illness. PTSD, possibly borderline personality disorder or schizophrenia. But none of that would save her. America didn't want nuance. It wanted a villain. And Warnos, poor, white, queer, mentally ill, sexually aggressive, made the perfect one. Chapter 2. Dying on Camera. Execution Day and Beyond. Is this justice? By 1993, Aileen Warnos had been sentenced to death 6 times. The state of Florida prepared to make an example of her. The public saw her as an aberration, a violent woman who killed for sport, then claimed victimhood. But behind the sensational headlines and macabre fascination, a darker question lingered. Was she even mentally competent to be executed? Numerous psychologists flagged Warnos as unstable. Dr. Diana Netter, who interviewed her during incarceration, described symptoms consistent with borderline personality disorder and antisocial tendencies. Others noted paranoid delusions. Her rambling interviews included claims that prison guards were contaminating her food, zapping her brain with radar, and manipulating her thoughts with sonic waves. The Florida Department of Corrections dismissed the concerns. They declared her sane, just difficult. And so the clock ticked forward. Meanwhile, her defenders argued that Aileen had never stood a chance. She was a traumatized child who turned into a weapon, forged by decades of male violence, institutional neglect, and street-level trauma. They didn't excuse her killings, but they questioned whether she had ever been capable of true agency. Was she a killer or a symptom? The fatal friendship. Throughout her incarceration, one woman continued to exploit her story. Arlene Prahler, a born-again Christian who had reached out to Warnos after reading about her in the newspaper. The two began a spiritual adoption relationship, with Prahler calling herself Aileen's mother. To some, Prahler offered comfort and faith. To others, she was a manipulator who used Warnos's notoriety to gain publicity for her own religious beliefs. Praller facilitated interviews, controlled access, and often spoke on Aileen's behalf. Meanwhile, Tyria Moore, the woman Warnos had loved and protected, had vanished into witness protection. She would later resurface for a brief, devastating moment. In 2001, prosecutors sought to verify Warnos's mental state once more. They arranged for Tyria to call her in prison. What happened during that phone call has haunted observers ever since. Aileen, thinking this was a real reconnection, broke down. She pleaded with Tyria to love her again. She said she was ready to die. When the call ended, it was clear. The last tie to her humanity had been severed. Tyria never spoke to her again. The final interview. British filmmaker Nick Broomfield had followed Warnos for nearly a decade. His first documentary, Aileen, The Selling of a Serial Killer, had exposed how the justice system, and even her own legal counsel, had profited off her story. But in 2002, Broomfield returned to film one last interview. What he found was a woman unraveling. Warnos ranted about sonic pressure in the prison. She said the FBI wanted to use her as an experiment. She claimed the police let her kill to drive up value for a future movie. Her eyes were wide, unblinking. Her voice swung from rage to serenity without warning. And yet, at the end of the interview, she looked straight into the camera and said, "I'm coming back. I'll be back. Like Independence Day. With Jesus." Was she insane? Was she performing? Or had the system finally broken what little was left of her mind? Execution Day. On October 9, 2002, at 9:47 a.m., Aileen Warnos was executed by lethal injection at Florida State Prison. She refused a last meal. Just a cup of coffee. Her final statement was brief, eerily theatrical. "Yes, I would just like to say I'm sailing with the Rock, and I'll be back like Independence Day with Jesus. June 6th, like the movie. Big mother's ship and all. I'll be back." She died at 46. No family claimed her body. The media was there in full force. Protesters outside the prison chanted. Feminists debated her legacy. The Florida governor who signed her death warrant, Jeb Bush, praised the justice system for carrying out the sentence without delay. But for those who had followed her life closely, the execution was not justice. It was a public erasure, a way to shut down uncomfortable questions by killing the person who embodied them. Afterlife in celluloid. Her death didn't end the story. It revived it. In 2003, Patty Jenkins's film Monster was released. Charlize Theron transformed herself into Warnos, delivering a haunting Oscar-winning performance. The film took the controversial route of framing Aileen as a victim-turned-killer, shaped by violence and betrayal. Critics were divided. The public was fascinated. Warnos, once ridiculed as a monster, was suddenly complex, a tragic antihero. For many, the film was their first introduction to the idea that perhaps, just perhaps, the world had failed Aileen Warnos long before she failed her victims, but it was too late. The woman was gone. The myth remained. A broken system exposed. Aileen Warnos's case has since become a staple in law school ethics debates, criminology textbooks, and feminist discourse. She is studied alongside names like Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer, but her profile doesn't quite fit. She wasn't methodical. She didn't seek fame. Her crimes weren't sexually motivated in the traditional sense. And she didn't kill from a position of power. She killed from fear, rage, and desperation. The more time passes, the more her story haunts us, not just because of what she did, but because of what we did to her. We didn't just execute a killer. We executed someone who had been groomed for death since the day she was born. Where are they now? Her story, in film and court before execution. Tyria Moore vanished into witness protection, but testified against Aileen in court. Her tearful courtroom testimony, in which she admitted asking Aileen to confess, devastated the defense. She later declined interviews and has remained anonymous to this day. She reportedly started a new life far from Florida, refusing all film and book inquiries. Arlene Praller continued to give interviews after Aileen's death, claiming her spiritual mission was complete. Critics accused her of exploiting Aileen's instability. She eventually faded from the public eye. Charlize Theron's portrayal in Monster won the Academy Award for Best Actress in 2004. Theron, a South African model-turned-actress, said the role left her emotionally raw. Director Patty Jenkins later described Warnos's story as the most morally complex case she'd ever encountered. Legal scholars continue to debate the constitutionality of executing someone with such severe mental illness. In the years since, stricter protections have been introduced. But too late for Warnos. Pop culture now sees Aileen as both villain and victim. She's featured in documentaries, Life and Death of a Serial Killer, music, podcasts, and even college courses on gender and crime. Her mugshot, wild hair, defiant glare, remains iconic. Her ashes were scattered under a tree in Michigan by her childhood friend Dawn Botkins, the same Aileen who once played in the dirt before anyone told her what her life would become.